Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Presidential Recess Appointments Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 26, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its decision in National Labor Relations Board v. Noel Canning. This case presented three questions arising from President Obama's attempt to make three recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB. First, it asked whether the president can exercise the recess appointment power during a temporary recess that occurs while the Senate is still in session, or is instead limited to recesses between enumerated sessions. Second, the case asked whether the president may exercise the recess appointment power to fill any vacancy that exists during a recess, including vacancies that arose before the recess occurred, or whether that power is limited to vacancies that arise during the recess. Finally, the case asked whether the Senate is in continuous recess if, though effectively out of town, it continues to convene every 3 days in brief pro forma sessions. In a 9-0 decision, the court found President Obama's attempted recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board invalid. In his opinion for the court, Justice Breyer ruled that the recess appointments clause empowers the president to fill any existing vacancy during any recess, whether it be intra-session or inter-session, of sufficient length. He also held that the phrase, vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate, applies both to vacancies that first arise during a recess and to vacancies that arise before a recess but continue to exist during the recess. And finally, he concluded that because the Senate was in session during its pro forma sessions, the recess during which the president made the appointments was only 3 days, and therefore too short to trigger the president's recess appointment authority. The appointments were therefore invalid. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined the opinion of the court. Justice Scalia filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which the Chief Justice and Justices Thomas and Alito joined. The opinion of the D.C. Circuit, which held that the recess appointments fell outside the scope of the clause, was affirmed. To discuss the case, we have Noel Francisco, who is a partner at Jones Day, Professor Kristen Hickman, who is the Harlan Albert Rogers Professor in Law and the Associate Director of the Corporate Institute at the University of Minnesota Law School, and Professor Michael B. Rappaport, who is the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and Director of the Center for the Study of Constitutional Originalism at the University of San Diego School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Francisco.
Let me start out by just giving our listeners a brief description of the case and what the court held. I'm going to assume that most people are generally familiar with it, so I'm going to try to avoid going into any excruciating detail, but I'll give enough background so that everybody who is only somewhat familiar with it has a sense for what happened, and then I'll offer a few comments on the different opinions that emerged. As you all probably recall, this case arose out of President Obama's really unique and unprecedented assertion of executive power in January 2012, where for the first time in American history, a president attempted to make recess appointments when the Senate was in fact convening sessions every 3 days. Those are the so-called pro forma sessions. Recess appointments are not new. Arguably unconstitutional recess appointments are not new. But what was new here was that this president took the recess appointments power further than any of his predecessors had ever gone, attempting to make appointments when the Senate was, under its rules, convening sessions on a regular basis. That's what led to this case, and that's what made our challenge to the president's recess appointments in this context uniquely vulnerable. And what we saw in the Supreme Court's decision yesterday was a resounding 9-0 rejection of the president's unprecedented assertion of executive power. I'll talk in a minute about the majority and the concurring opinions, which reached the same result, albeit through significantly different reasoning. But one point I'd like to emphasize is that the majority opinion, authored by Justice Breyer, joined by the other four liberal justices on the court, was a square and unequivocal rejection of the legal reasoning advanced by the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel that purportedly attempted to justify these recess appointments. That Office of Legal Counsel opinion was based just about exclusively on the assertion that the president had the authority to declare that the Senate's sessions lawfully held every 3 days were constitutional shams. And the majority opinion authored by Justice Breyer, joined by Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and also Justice Kennedy, resoundingly rejected that position. So let me give you just a thumbnail sketch of what the majority held for the court and what the concurrence articulated as its rationale for joining the judgment of that court. There were essentially three questions presented, all of the resolution of any of which in our favor would have resulted in the invalidation of these recess appointments. The first question presented was, could the president make recess appointments during breaks that occurred within a Senate session? These are the so-called intra-session breaks. Or is that power limited to the break that falls in between the Senate's formal sessions? The second question was, assuming that the Senate is in recess at any given time, which vacancies are eligible for a recess appointment? The question would be, are all vacancies that happen to exist during a recess of the Senate eligible for recess appointments, or are the eligible vacancies limited to a subset of vacancies that exist during the Senate's recess? That is, those vacancies that not only exist during the recess of the Senate, but also that arose during the recess of the Senate. And then the third question presented goes to the validity of these pro forma sessions. Can the president make recess appointments when the Senate is convening sessions every 3 days, including so-called pro forma sessions in which it gavels into and out of session relatively quickly, but during which it is capable of conducting business if it wants to? The majority of the court, in an opinion authored by Justice Breyer, held that the president could make recess appointments during any substantial break in Senate action, regardless of whether that break fell between sessions or during a session, and could make those appointments to any vacancy that existed during that so-called recess. But Justice Breyer agreed with us on the third question presented, and he held that for a break to constitute a recess, it must be at least 3 days long, and for purposes of calculating that period, pro forma sessions were fully valid sessions. The Senate said they were valid sessions, and during those sessions, the Senate was in fact capable of conducting business if it wanted to. So what emerged from the majority opinion is essentially a three-part rule. The first part of the rule says that any break of 3 days or less is not a recess, period, full stop. That's not a recess. If there's a break between 4 and 10 days long, it is presumptively not a recess. We're not 100% sure what exactly the presumptively means. What it means is that it's probably not a recess unless the president has a really, really good reason for explaining why there was such an emergency that he had to act during a break of between 4 and 10 days. And for a break that is longer than 10 days, that is a recess during which the president can make recess appointments. But the critical part of that rule is Justice Breyer's holding that for purposes of calculating how long the Senate is or is not in session, it's up to the Senate to determine whether it's in session. So if the Senate says it's in session and holds these pro forma sessions every 3 days, as it was doing when the president made these recess appointments, there is no recess, and the president can make no recess appointments. The concurring justices, in an opinion authored by Justice Scalia, would have resolved this case quite differently in terms of their reasoning. They would have held that recess appointments were limited to inter-session recesses, that is, the formal recess that falls in between the Senate's formal sessions, and further, that the only vacancies that are eligible for recess appointments are those vacancies that happen to arise during the recess of the Senate. Justice Scalia grounded his opinion in the text and the original understanding of the clause. The majority and the dissent joined argument in terms of how historical practice played into this. The majority's view, in my judgment, was that we were probably right, and Justice Scalia was probably right on the text and original understanding of the clause, but that it was sufficiently ambiguous that historical practice was relevant, and the majority thought that the historical record was too strong to allow it to go the other way on those first two questions presented. Justice Scalia viewed the text and history quite differently. He viewed the text as unambiguous on both of the first two questions, and the history as ambiguous and arguable, and in that context, his view was that the historical practice cannot overcome the unambiguous text, and unambiguous original understanding of the clauses. So that's essentially how it came down. A 9-0 decision on the result, five justices ruling that the recess appointments are invalid under the, so the third question presented involving the so-called pro forma sessions, four justices holding that the recess appointments were invalid under the first two questions presented, which go to the original understanding of the clause and when recess appointments can be made and which vacancies are eligible for recess appointments. To take a step back and just to give a couple of big picture comments on it, in my view, I know that Professor Rappaport has written extensively and powerful articles on the original understanding of the clause, and I think, you know, in my judgment, he's right on that. Those are the positions that we also articulated in this case. But I don't think that there is a lot of practical difference between the majority opinion and the opinion of the concurring justices. To be sure, they adopted very different ways to reach the same result. But going forward, I think both rules pretty much give the Senate back its authority in the appointments process, because under both sets of reasoning, it's now up to the Senate to determine, under its rules, when it's in recess, thus giving rise to the recess appointments power. So both of them, in terms of their bottom line result, and in my judgment, restore the constitutional order in which the president cannot make recess appointments in order to do an end run around Senate advice and consent. He maybe can do it when the Senate is truly unavailable, but he can't do it simply because the Senate does not want to confirm his nominees, and they get us to basically the same place. So although I would agree that Justice Scalia's opinion is more doctrinally pure and, in my judgment, is correct, I am equally happy with the opinion that Justice Breyer issued, because I do think that it restores the constitutional order, if not necessarily in every jot and tittle of its reasoning, certainly in its bottom line rule. With that, I'll turn it over to Professor Rappaport.
Well, thanks, Noel. Although I was disappointed by the overall result in the Supreme Court, I kind of have a mixed reaction to the decision from the perspective of both originalism and the original meaning of the recess appointments clause. On the one hand, a majority decision by Justice Breyer is almost always a bad thing for originalism. And that was true in Noel Canning. The majority got the type of recess issue wrong, and it got the happen issue wrong for the first two issues that Noel talked about. But I can't even take solace in the majority's conclusion that the recess appointments were illegal, because I think it's likely that the pro forma sessions were not actually constitutional sessions. More on this in a minute. On the other hand, the originalist result came very close to winning, got four votes. When I first wrote my article on the original meaning of the recess appointments clause in 2005, which set forth the position articulated by Justice Scalia in the concurrence, virtually no one adopted the view that I defended. And even after the D.C. Circuit decided Noel Canning, an astute observer of the Supreme Court's separation of powers jurisprudence, Professor Peter Shane, said on a Federalist podcast, this exactly like this one, that he would buy me dinner if anyone other than Justice Thomas adopted my view of the Happen issue. Yet four justices adopted this view. Moreover, there was good reason to be skeptical that Justices Alito and Roberts would sign on. Both of them have histories in the executive branch and therefore might be hesitant to limit the president's recess appointment power. And both of them have emphasized questions of practice, with Justice Alito especially seeming to be skeptical of originalism. Yet both join the opinion with no reservation. Now, moving from originalism to limiting executive power, the majority's decision is a little bit better. It does mean that the Senate can stop recess appointments by holding pro forma sessions, Noel was saying. But I'm not so sure that's going to work out so well unless both houses are controlled by the opposing party of the president. If the House and the Senate are controlled by different parties, then the House controlling the president's party is not going to agree to a pro forma session. Right? So they're going to have, so the House, for one House might say, we're going to continue to meet every 3 days. And the other one says, no, we want to meet in 30 days from now. They'll have a disagreement as to the time of their adjournment. And possibly, we don't have much experience with this, but the Constitution appears to give the president the power to determine the length of the adjournment, which would mean, so if the two houses disagree and the president steps in to resolve the dispute, which the Constitution seems to give him that power, then he's going to say, oh, well, we'll meet again, the two houses will meet again in more than 10 days. And then, of course, he can make a recess appointment. Justice Breyer's opinion was obviously not an originalist opinion. You know, and as with most non-originalists, he attempted to camouflage this by claiming that the language was ambiguous. But I think there are two problems with this. First, he was way too quick to decide that the language was ambiguous. It's not enough to say, oh, there were two meanings of recess at the time of the Constitution. That's true enough. But it's pretty clear that the ordinary meaning, which would allow even a 30-minute recess to count as a recess, was not employed in the Constitution. Once you looked at the additional circumstances, these so-called ambiguities get largely resolved. Second, Justice Breyer's opinion looks to purpose based on either modern circumstances or historical circumstances as it suits his argument. For example, he attempts to justify having different lengths for intersession recess appointments and intra-session recess appointments on the ground that the intra-session recess appointments need to have at least a year to allow an appointment to be made. But this makes sense, if it does at all, only under the assumption that we live in the modern world where appointments take 3 to 4 months to make and sometimes take 6 months to make. But at the same time, Justice Breyer allows a 10-day break to count as a recess. But in the modern world where appointments take 3 to 6 months, a mere 10-day break is not enough to justify a recess appointment. If it makes sense, it only makes sense in the 18th century world where appointments were made much more quickly. So he's shifting between the 18th century and the 21st century, depending on which kind of purpose argument he wants to make. Thus, Justice Breyer's purpose methodology is so flexible that it allows him to reach whatever result he likes. And since text has such a limited role for him, there's very little constraint on where he wants to go. Finally, let me explain briefly, and this is oh so briefly, why I question the majority's conclusion that the pro forma sessions counts. Pro forma session counts as a real session. A pro forma session involves two or three senators meeting for a minute or two. They hit the gavel, a minute later they hit the gavel again. Typically. But those senators would not have a quorum to do business. The Constitution establishes that a majority of the senators constitutes a quorum. One or two does not. And therefore, if they don't have a quorum, I don't think they're allowed to act, and they're not really in session. I seriously question the legislation. I don't fully understand how it gets enacted, but if two senators are up there and they pass legislation, I think that's unconstitutional. But there's a lot more to be said about this matter, but the short of it is that I think it's hard to conclude that the Senate is in session to do business without a quorum. Okay, let me pass it on to you, Kristen.
Thanks, Mike. And some of my comments are going to reflect a few of the comments that Noel and Mike made. But let me go forward with them anyway. I know that this case will be and is being painted by some people as an instance of pragmatism trumping a cramped and unrealistic formalism or originalism. But in that regard, Justice Breyer's opinion strikes me as representing a sort of faux pragmatism that only lawyers and ideologues can love or find convincing. On the one hand, he is right that we have had quite a number of recess appointments in the past that would have been unconstitutional under the D.C. circuits and the dissent's interpretation of the Recess Appointments Clause. And I think that is why he writes the opinion the way he does. He simply does not want to say that presidents have been violating the Constitution for all of these years. But Justice Breyer can't come out and say that that's his reason for finding the case outcome as he does. So instead, to justify giving the president a broad theoretical recess appointment power that would accommodate most, if not all, of those past recess appointments, Justice Breyer finds ambiguity in the Constitution's use of the words "the" and "happen," and relies on that ambiguity to justify emphasizing historical interpretation and practice, as well as the purpose of the Recess Appointments Clause, which he describes as the president needing to be able to ensure the continued functioning of the government whenever the Senate is unavailable to act on his appointments. When I described Justice Breyer's opinion last night to a highly educated, relatively sophisticated, but non-lawyer friend, he snorted that quibbling over the meaning of words like "the" and "happen" is why people hate lawyers. Or as a judge I know like to say, some people will find ambiguity in a stop sign. I agree with Mike that Justice Breyer got to ambiguity way too fast. I've seen him spend a lot more time in Chevron opinions, you know, applying various tools of statutory construction to avoid finding ambiguity. So that part of his opinion seems a little strained. I find Justice Breyer's historical account, and particularly his reliance on the purpose of the Recess Appointments Clause, also to be incredibly strained. I really haven't tracked all of the ins and outs of the history myself, but Justice Breyer seems to be using history not only to demonstrate that presidents have been making recess appointments for a long time, but also to illustrate the Senate needing to be available so that the president can keep the government functioning, supposedly finding a consensus about that need. So, for example, at one point, he relies quite heavily on a passage from a report of the Senate Judiciary Committee from 1905 as defining the phrase "the recess" in functional terms that emphasize the Senate's unavailability during any recess, whether intersession or intrasession. Yet not only was that report criticizing a set of recess appointments made by Teddy Roosevelt, it was written in 1905 when most of America still relied on letters and telegraphs for communication and on trains and horses for transportation. So sure, in that era, any adjournment of the Senate really did make the Senate unavailable for consultation. But that's not the world we live in now. The idea that the Senate is ever really unavailable, or for that matter that the government's functioning would be imperiled by the amount of time it takes to consult the Senate about an appointment, is just implausible. Similarly, in his discussion of the meaning of the word "happen," Justice Breyer argues that restricting recess appointments further would prevent the president from making any recess appointment that arose before a recess, no matter who the official, no matter how dire the need, no matter how uncontroversial the appointment, and no matter how late in the session the office fell vacant. But what exactly does Justice Breyer expect to happen? What possible set of events could happen in the limited amount of time that Congress adjourns these days that couldn't be handled by the army of remaining government officials, particularly given that the Vacancies Act usually allows the president to fill these sorts of vacancies with temporary acting administrators. For that matter, if something so dire were to occur that we just had to have a new appointment that quickly, surely such dire circumstances would lead the Senate to cut short whatever vacation it is enjoying to hurry back to Washington. The theme of Senate unavailability during its various adjournments is what really drives Justice Breyer's reasoning. But the fact is that recess appointments in recent decades haven't been a consequence of the Senate being unavailable to consider the president's appointments. Rather, they've been a consequence of the Senate refusing to confirm particular nominees who have been controversial. Whether rightly or wrongly, the Senate doesn't have completely clean hands here either. But the entire premise of Justice Breyer's opinion on the unavailability of the Senate just rings false. Getting back then to Justice Breyer's preference of not declaring long-standing government practices as unconstitutional, to a great extent, I find Justice Breyer's opinion here very similar to his opinion in the Free Enterprise Fund case concerning the president's removal power a few years ago. In both cases, Justice Breyer's emphasis seemed to be on trying to interpret the Constitution to uphold long-standing existing practices in general, complete with appendices reflecting a sort of pseudo-scientific attempt to back up his view with data. In both cases, the subtext of Justice Breyer's opinion seemed to be that if a practice is well established in government as it exists, then the practice must be okay. This approach gets cast as a pragmatic and restrained approach, you know, for the court's refusal to interfere drastically with the status quo. But the problem with this approach is that particularly in a system in which we have a variety of justiciability limitations that keep the courts from considering issues until they are properly brought as a case or controversy, and we have a Supreme Court that only takes a small number of cases each year, it often takes decades before a serious constitutional question gets addressed. And of course, by then, the practice in question has been around for a long time and is thus de facto settled. So sure, the republic hasn't fallen, but that doesn't mean we haven't lost something. I tend to think of it sort of this way. You can destroy a boulder by blowing it up with explosives, but over time you can just as effectively destroy a boulder by putting it where the tide can get at it and letting the water wear it away slowly until there's nothing left. And the latter is what I think an approach like Justice Breyer's does to the Constitution. Regardless, as a more immediate and practical matter, it seems to me that we're right that recess appointments are at least somewhat on the wane, less because of this case than because of last fall's change in the Senate's rules with respect to cloture in the context of recess appointments and appointments generally. The old cloture rule required 60 senators to agree to end debate before the Senate could hold a confirmation vote, with the result that even when the same party controlled the presidency and the Senate, a minority of senators could block presidential appointments. That was a common occurrence during the administrations of both Presidents Obama and George W. Bush, although it's not what happened in this case. In November of last year, though, a majority of the senators voted to change the cloture rule to allow a simple majority of 51 votes to end debate with respect to most judicial and all executive branch appointments. Only Supreme Court appointments were excluded from that rule change. And as a result of the rule change, so long as the same party controls the presidency and the Senate, I doubt we will see very many recess appointments. Where the Noel Canning decision becomes important is when we have different parties that hold the presidency and the Senate, which was the case with respect to the appointments at issue in Noel Canning and will undoubtedly occur again in the future. If not after this fall's elections, then at some other point in time. Noel Canning tells the Senate what it has to do to prevent the president from making recess appointments: hold pro forma sessions. That's a hassle, but I have no doubt that the Senate will be able to do just that, at least to a degree. So at the very least, as a practical matter, I think Noel is right that Justice Breyer has given the Senate a helpful tool to protect its prerogative. But Justice Breyer's opinion also sets us up not only for a series of pro forma Senate sessions, but for the kind of arcane quibbling over procedural rules that average Americans just hate to see out of Washington. Justice Breyer's opinion is pretty unequivocal about that 3-day break never being sufficient. But the 10-day limit is just a presumption, and it's a rebuttable presumption. Justice Breyer suggests that a national catastrophe would be sufficient to overcome that presumption, but he doesn't define what constitutes a national catastrophe, nor does he say that only a national catastrophe is sufficient to overcome the presumption. And facing a Senate controlled by the opposing party, one can easily imagine presidents claiming all sorts of reasons to overcome Justice Breyer's presumption and justify recess appointments, and we can just see our representatives in Washington and the president arguing back and forth about whether the president has adequate justification to justify recess appointments under the Supreme Court's opinion. Moreover, Justice Breyer spends lots of time in his opinion on the arcana of Senate rules. And Mike already talked about what happens if the two houses disagree over the length of an adjournment. It's precisely this kind of arcane gamesmanship that brings many Americans to have nothing but contempt for elected officials in both parties of Congress. And I don't think setting that kind of situation up is very pragmatic at all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.